Next Sunday is, it feels different, doesn't it? Next Sunday is Potted Plant Day. And it's a new phrase for a new initiative that I think is just absolutely fantastic. And it wasn't my idea, but I think it's one of the best ideas I've ever heard a church doing. This is really hip. I think Martin will affirm, Martin's here, that this is right up there with one of the best strategies. Potted Plant Day, this is how it works. There's a whole lot of potted plants that will be here next week, and Steph's arranged, worked out on a map some of the houses in our area here, and she'd like 20 teams. Now, a team could be a couple, team could be a small group, team could be an individual, but you put your hand up and you say, we're a team, or I'm a team, and then you get given a few plants, and you get given a few houses, and at the end of the service next week, you drive up there or walk up there, knock on the door and say, g'day.
G'day.
That'll win them. And then say, here's a gift from us. We're from the local church down the road and we just want to let you know we're here. And you know what, next week, so that's in 2 weeks' time, you can say next week we've got our launch which is just setting up the year and you can come and see some of the things we do. And if 20 teams do that, we're going to cover about 100 houses. And that might not sound like much. You might think, you know what, it's hardly worth it. It's not like they're going to come. But I assure you, if we do this, there will be fruit. Even some of the people that might look just nonplussed, you know, who knows what might happen to them in 2 years' time and they need a community. You know, who knows what kind of grief they might hit. And what I find in my own experience is this. A local church like ours, the people who live in our immediate vicinity, sometimes they think we've closed down. It's weird, but sometimes they do because they don't know us. And sometimes you do this kind of thing and people think, oh, you guys are still open. So this is really worthwhile. And this is really hip. It really is in terms of being an embedded church. And we, you and I both know that Christians and non-Christians have had enough of churches that are insular. And this is right up there. I think this is really living into the kind of missional community and embedded neighbourhood community we want to be. So would you seriously consider not leaving it up to other people, but forming a team, either with yourself or a friend or your family, and knocking on a few doors? Does it sound good? What do you reckon? Yep. Yeah, I think it's fantastic. So Potted Plant Day. Awesome. Right, back to camping. So our family's at Sasquatch this weekend, and I didn't want to lose the spirit, so I've brought the rider's camping chair. We've borrowed the rider's RV for the weekend, and I've brought the Ken stubble. Feels good, Ken. And I've got the awful camping tea. The milk's gone off because the fridge isn't working. Huh? Oh, it is. But there's a few reasons why I'm in a camping chair. I'll explain as we go on. But just to introduce this series, for the next month, I mean, I've been thinking for the last month, how would I want to finish preaching here? And this is how. I think this series, I think, says everything I want to say. And what this series is it explains the whole biblical story in 4 weeks so that at the end of the month, you'll have in your head how the whole Bible fits together. But more than that, it explains the whole biblical story in a way that you can copy. In other words, I'm trying to help us all to tell the biblical story to our friends and family, especially those who have big questions or don't know anything about Jesus at all. So in other words, this series is called Telling the Biblical Story. Telling the Biblical Story. When I was a teenager, a teacher of mine, Graham Collins, took us, my friend Andrew and myself, for a number of hikes. We would sit around the campfire and he would tell us stories from the Bible and tell us about Jesus. And those days, sitting with Mr. Collins around the campfire, were so formative to me, for me. And that's part of the reason why I got a campfire chair here and a bad cup of tea in my hand and stubble on my chin. Just to think of those places where you comfortably speak to your friends and your family. Maybe it's around the campfire, maybe it's at school in the playground, maybe it's in the office, maybe it's in the workshop. And we're thinking about telling the biblical story. And what I'm going to work really hard to do this month is to kick it off each time with key questions that people ask us, and then to tell a biblical story, to explain in winsome ways the true story of the world, where Jesus Christ is Lord, Saviour, Creator. Does that sound okay? I'm really excited about this series. I've said to Erin, I think, more times than I ever have for any series, I'm really excited about this series. Can I just encourage you before we start to try and listen to all four? I'll email out the handouts and I'll try and get them up on the web as well, so you can keep all four handouts and really work these handouts. And there's pencils there in the pews you might want to write. Circle the things you might want to repeat. Circle the things that sound meaningful and communicatable to you so that you can really engage this. Now, finally, would you just raise your hand, please, if you don't have a set of notes for yourself? It might be good that everyone individually has a set of notes. And Ruth and Andy, just raise your hand if you would. Andy, would just raise your hand high if you don't have a set of notes. Excellent, thanks. Okay. So you can just get a sense from the screen there of the sweep of this series. So just going to the next slide here, what we're going to focus on today is Genesis 1 to 3, creation and fall, the first chapter of the biblical story. And I'm just going to do Genesis chapter 3, the fall, very, very briefly at the end. We're going to focus on Genesis 1 and 2, creation, right now. But I think here are some of the questions that Genesis 1 and 2 and 3 1 and 2 addresses. Questions in particular that arise from the perception that Christianity is disconnected from the real world. You know the kind of questions I mean. Christians are only interested in the spiritual, in the heavenly, some people can think. Or second, you know, I'm surprised that you Christians are having so much fun, and for certain generations, without getting drunk and doing drugs. Or third, God does not seem interested in this world, in stopping war or stopping hunger. Or, not so much challenging Christianity, but just that kind of searching existential question, we need sure ground from which to insist that this world matters. You know, in other words, how, if I'm passionate about the environment, how can I insist that this environment does matter? That how I use plastic bottles does matter? How can I insist to someone who disagrees? Well, there are our questions. Ken, could you just chuck another log on the fire? It's cooling down. Thanks, mate. Okay. So I think as Christians, you and I, we can make the mistake of forgetting that this world matters to God. Just think of some of the phrases we use. I can't wait to get to heaven. Well, heaven is my home. You know, on one hand, it sounds really obvious that this world matters to God. But on the other hand, is this always the way that we think and speak and act? And I will just say as an aside, I think that those phrases that I just quoted are unhelpful phrases. Now, this is fascinating. Genesis 1 and 2. Israel's neighbors, the background of Genesis 1 and 2, the Babylonians, the Assyrians, the Hittites, their neighbors, the context into which the Old Testament is written, thought that this world doesn't matter. In the ancient Near East, the background of the Old Testament, the world was a backwater location. It was a second-class suburb. The world was an accidental outcome of the life of the gods. Now let me explain. Here's how the clouds got there and the ocean got there in Babylonian mythology. The chief deity Marduk slayed a goddess, Tiamat. Having slayed Tiamat, now Tiamat stands for water. And Marduk then cut Tiamat's body in two, and one half of her body became the clouds, the other half became the ocean. Now, of course, it's barbaric, but it's also an illustration of how this world is just the accidental outcome of the life of the gods. It doesn't really matter. It's not created with care and concern in the ancient Near East. Into that background, Genesis chapter 1 is written. Have a look, if you would, at the beginning of Genesis chapter 1, verse 3 and 4, and we'll just look at day 1 and day 2. That will do us to make a point. Day 1, verse 3, and God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, and God saw that the light was good. Now just read those verses carefully. In the ancient, unpredictable gods behave erratically in the ancient Near East, killing one another, and the world is made. But Israel's God speaks with creative authority. Design and order pervade. Let there be light. And since this world is made with design, life in this world isn't random, isn't fatalistic. Life can be lived with confidence. A totally different world, Israel's world. Have a look at day 2 from verse 6. It's fascinating. And have a look at this. Fascinating. Have a look at verse 6. And God said, here's the intention, "Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters, and let it separate the waters from the waters." The expanse is the sky, separating the waters above from the waters below. So the waters of the sky and the sea are separated. In Babylonian mythology, the waters are the slain body of Tiamat. For Israel, however, the world is not the collateral damage of cosmic violence, but a gift. Isn't that fantastic? And note this from chapter 1 of Genesis. And you might, if you want, just listen back to January 2011, where we did Genesis, and listen back to the sermon on Genesis chapter 1, where we noted, you'll remember, that the word good is used 7 times. The Hebrew word for good is tov, and 7 is a symbol of completeness. And so, we heard it just then as it was read. And it was good, and it was tov, and it was tov, and it was tov, and it was tov. And you get to the end of the chapter, and it was tov ma'ov, and it was very good. Fantastic. No Babylonian or Assyrian would ever say that about the world. So let me summarize what we learn from Genesis chapter 1. Here we go. First, at the heart of reality is a generous God. Second, this world matters to God. Third, this world is good and delightful. Fourth, the world is ordered, made with design. You see, Israel's creation account isn't just an explanation of how we got here. It challenges the prevailing worldview. Genesis 1 and 2 is asking fundamental questions like, why are we here? What is our relationship to the deity? And what is this world that we live in? And at the risk of simplification, as I balance my glass here, at the risk of simplification, I think that Genesis chapter 1 puts a huge banner over all of creation. And if you were to read that huge banner, you would read these words: this world matters to God. And if you were to turn that banner around and read the other side, it would say something like this: a first-class world. What a fantastic chapter. And so, to go to our most quoted quote of the last 2 years, Gordon Spikeman. It's on the sheet there, I think. God's creation is evidence of the caring hand of the Creator, reaching out to secure the well-being of His creatures, of a Father extending a universe full of blessings to His children. Well, now then, before we go back to our questions and our campfire conversation, let's have a campfire song. And back at a... there's not a pulpit at the campsite. You can't put your cup of tea there. Just to go back to Christmas, I think it was Christmas Day, Aaron and I work hard at thinking through songs to sing with our kids that teach them the biblical story. And sometimes you've got to critique Christian songs. And one of the ones that we often sing still is "Oh, How I Love Jesus." You know the song? "Oh, How I Love Jesus." Do you know that one? Yep. And so we get the kids We try and show the cosmic scope, the universal scope of God's interest. So it's not just for me, just for me, as if the whole Bible is a letter just addressed to me. The whole Bible is a love letter, if it is, of God's heart for his whole world. And so we say to Marla, what is something that Christ cares for? Marla, what is something that Christ cares for? Do you want to tell us? Trees, okay. So because he loves the tree. Yeah? Oh, how I love trees. Lovely. Is there any other children here who would like to share with us something else that Jesus cares for? You can just, who would like to do that? Who would like to share something that Jesus, yes. Other people, yeah, wonderful. Because he loves other people. That'll work. Let's do one more. What's something else that Jesus cares for, boys and girls? Something with one syllable will be preferable. Yes. Animals. Yes, animals. Yep, we can do that. Good woe. Hard to fit a grand piano into your RV, but you can fit a guitar. That was a good campfire song. So let's go back to those questions now. Let's go back to the questions. They're on your sheet there. And so I've hazarded some campfire answers or some office answers that we can share with our family and friends. Just to go to that next slide there. Question one. You know, Christianity seems disconnected from the real world. Christians are only interested in the spiritual, the heavenly. Obviously, you've got to find the words that are natural for you, but something like Christianity, the Bible, is about a God who is committed to his world, and he is loving his world to life. Well, here's question two. I'm surprised you Christians are having so much fun, depending on the age, without getting drunk or doing drugs. Something like this. God has given us this world as a generous gift to enjoy. The Bible is an invitation to party. And it is. It is. That's a big part of the theme of Genesis chapter 1. It's the abundance. It's the joy of it, isn't it? It's the delight of God. Question 3. God doesn't seem interested in stopping wars or hunger. And that's a quote from the Sydney Morning Herald, by the way. It's a direct quote from the Sydney Morning Herald. So that's not a hypothetical question. Response, God created the world with care and he's committed to its thriving. Question 4, doesn't evolution disprove Christianity? Yeah. I don't mind if you disagree with me on this, that's cool. Genesis chapter 1 isn't a scientific explanation of how we got here. Its message is much more wonderful. The Bible declares into our present reality of climate change, deforestation and species extinction, this world matters to God, as Grace said. Now, question 5, so this one isn't so much a challenge to Christianity, but just that searching existential question that I think so many Westerners have. We need sure ground to insist that this world matters. You know, people, whether Christian or not, we often get into conversations where something we know matters, such as climate change. I'm regularly in conversations with people. I mean, when I say, I'm often in conversations with people and they will say, well, it doesn't really matter that much. And then what do? It's my opinion against them. How can we really say that this stuff matters? And this is a conundrum that Christians have and people who aren't Christians have. But the point is that here is an authority that God speaks. I have made a good world and you will care for it. That's fantastic news. This isn't up for grabs. This isn't a discussion to have. The decision's been made. We've got to care for this world because there's a God who made it with care and delight. That's the fifth one. Well, let's now, round our campfire, just briefly touch down on Genesis chapter 3, which is when Adam and Eve sin and corruption come into the world. And if we're going to do the biblical story, we've got to get past chapter 2 in the first week. And the fall is just such an important movement in the biblical story that we can't skip it. So it'll just take 5 minutes. It won't take long this time. So another log on the fire, Ken. Actually, some people around the campfire were explaining to me last night what a s'more is. Does anyone know what a s'more is? Yeah, I smugly told them we have them in Australia. So don't think we know. But we don't have celebrations in Australia. Those chocolate biscuits, is that what you use for s'mores? They're kind of a biscuit with chocolate on top, so you don't have to go to the trouble of buying the chocolate and the biscuit. It's very handy. We don't have them in Australia. Start a little business in Sydney for all the hikers. Okay, so let's now get our minds into gear around Genesis chapter 3. We're in the garden, Adam and Eve. Here are some questions that Genesis chapter 3 might address. Why do Christians talk about sin all the time? Or second, how could a good God allow all this suffering? A pressing question. Or this kind of searching question, not so much a challenge to the Bible, but just a searching question. Why is this world such a mess? All right. Again, you might like to listen to the sermon in January 2011 on Genesis chapter 3. But just to note, I think, that the story of Adam and Eve, it does sound ludicrous to many Westerners. Two naked people eating apples with a snake. I mean, come on. But truly, the wisdom of this text is extraordinary. And it rings true according to its purpose. Goodness me. It is asking, in ancient Near Eastern literary terms, fundamental questions. What is this world like? What is the relationship of humanity to God and the world? Why is there this mess? It is such a wise text. So you and I both know the story, and so do our friends. The whole thing opens with a snake in verse 1. Just have a quick look at it. Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. It opens as a snake presents God as a killjoy. Did God really say, you may not eat from any tree in the garden? Did he really say that? Not much of a fun God, this God. And then, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, here, Eve becomes a partner in the first conversation about God. And as this story unfolds, there are three relationships that are broken. There is estrangement between humanity, estrangement between Adam and Eve, and they're blaming one another. The woman gave me the fruit and I ate. And there's estrangement from God. God appears in the garden and they hide from God. They hide. Why are you hiding, says God? And then third, there is estrangement. There is broken relationship from the rest of creation and humanity. And so, with the sweat of his brow, Adam works the soil. And Eve gives birth with pain. And so everything is broken now. Sin brings a deep corruption into the world. So that Al Walters, the wonderful Dutch Reformed scholar at Redeemer University, a friend of ours, says this: this is an event of catastrophic significance for creation as a whole. That is such a significant line. People don't get this. This is an event of catastrophic significance for creation as a whole. Humanity is living against the created order. We are cutting against the grain of creation. Camp firewood metaphor. We're living in defiance of the Creator and therefore corrupting this good creation. Here is the disintegration of the good created order. And to quote now Al Walters at length, just listen to this. I haven't written this down, but this is profound. Al says, "This is an event of catastrophic significance for creation as a whole. The effects of sin touch all of creation." Now listen to this. "No created thing is in principle untouched by the corrosive effects of the fall. Whether we look," Al says, "at societal structures such as the state of family or cultural pursuits such as art or technology or bodily functions such as sexuality or eating or anything at all within the wide scope of creation, we discover that the good handiwork of God," listen to this, "has been drawn into the sphere of human mutiny against God." And then he quotes Paul. "The whole of creation," Paul writes, "has been groaning as in the pain of childbirth right up until the present time," Romans 8:22. And I tell you, I mean, just moving towards the campfire here and explaining this to our friends, this is a story that I've told to a number of my friends. You know, people say, how can there be a good God, you know, when the world's like a mess like this, you know? And I say, you've got to understand that most of the misery in this world is by the hands of humanity. People kill one another. People make one another's lives a misery. And then my friends say, yeah, but not all. What about drought? And I think we have to think beyond Western categories and realize a spiritual dimension and realize that because of sin, the very fabric of creation is corrupted. And my friends are very often very willing to grant this. It's only a Westerner that can say that things aren't all connected. Only a Westerner that is willing to deny a spiritual realm. And I share with my friends, I have a friend back at home, Jim, who lived next door to me. And Jim's a retiree. I haven't caught up with him since we moved here. But after World War II, Jim went to Belsen in Germany. He went and lived in the town of Belsen where the concentration camp was. 50,000 people were killed there. He went there to be part of the cleanup. 20,000 Russian prisoners of war, 50,000 Jewish people, and others. And when Belsen was liberated, the Allies found 13,000 unburied bodies. Unthinkable. And Jim went there straight after the war. And he said, you know what? He said, Belsen was alive with movement of animals and birds. He said, but no animals ran through the concentration camp. Within that compound, there weren't any animals. And he said, the birds didn't fly overhead. And why is this? Because things are connected. Because evil is evil. And evil corrupts the fabric of creation. We can't think our sin stops with us. Humanity's sin does see deeply into the earth of this world. And I think it's hardly a human being that wouldn't grout that once we've thought about it. So let's go to our questions now. First, why do Christians talk about sin all the time? Well, because the effects of sin, it touches all of creation. It's not just us, including the climate, family breakdown, poverty, refugee policy. We're part of the mess. That's what we talk about, sin. We're grieving the grief of the world. Question two. How can a good God allow all of this suffering? Great question. Well, I mean, I want to answer this with humility. I want to answer this with tears. I don't want to pretend I got a quick fix. But somewhere along the line, I want to say, humanity is directly responsible for much of the suffering in this world, if not all. And the very fabric of creation is corrupted because of human sin. You know, I don't want to deny, again, getting outside the Western context, we've got to acknowledge a spiritual realm. You know, we've got to acknowledge that stuff. Most Westerners now even believe in a spiritual realm. If there's a good spiritual realm, there's a bad spiritual realm as well. And then that searching question, why is this world such a mess? And I think here, the biblical story is very helpful here. Human sin is a reality of catastrophic significance for creation as a whole. And we've got to put our hand up and own this. Well, there's our first campfire session out of four. We're up to Genesis chapter 3, inching our way through the biblical story. But I just want to flag at this point, very briefly, what I always try and say around the campfire or in the office or in the workshop or wherever. I always try and say this phrase. I always try and say, it's all about Jesus. And I find in my convos, if I say that, it gets me oriented right. Because I can start to, in these hard conversations, I can start to go off on all sorts of tangents. You know how it is. I get confused myself. You know, you get confused, don't you? You say it's all about Jesus. And somehow it gets you on the railway track. So just say this with me. It's all about Jesus. 1, 2, 3. It's all about Jesus. And in this context of these questions, you know, it's all about Jesus. Jesus made this world. He sustains it. He gives you and I our every breath. Jesus is committed to his world. You know, something like that. And then we're just getting to the important. It's all about Jesus. You know, in context of the mess, I have hope for this broken world because Jesus died, he rose again to secure its future. It doesn't have to be long, but just to show this is what it's all about, you know. Well, I'm going to get back to my campfire at Sasquatch after sharing a cup of tea with you after the worship service. Let's pray now for our campfire conversations and our office conversations. Jesus, thank you that you are someone who is a God who is committed to this world. We thank you it's not a Babylonian world, an accidental outcome, the life of the gods. We thank you it's not a secular world, that the secular worldview doesn't have the last say, where in the end there is no ultimate hope. In the end, if it's a mess, it's a flipping mess, and we despair. We thank you for Christ. We thank you that you loved this world to life. And because you did, that is a token that you still love it. The love we see in creation is a token that you will love it. You'll return and fix this world up. Thank you for giving us our every breath, a token that you're committed to its future and our future as well. Thank you that you love this world. And we love you because you love this world. We love you, Jesus, because you love the trees. We love you, Jesus, because you love the animals. We love you because you grieve the raising of the temperature of your globe. We love you because you grieve things that should be grieved. Thank you for Christ. It's all about him. Amen.